This is the Oil Sand Tech Podcast
with Aaron Shearhart.
The oil sand industry is the largest unconventional oil business in Canada. And on this podcast, we'll be interviewing people who are building products and building services that can improve the oil sands. We tell the story of how to build products and bring them to market. The Oil Sand Tech Podcast. And now, Aaron Shearhart.
Welcome to episode two. So on the show today, I had the opportunity to sit down and have a chat with Jason Swist of Crude Solutions. Jason is one of the only independent entrepreneurs that are currently building IP-based solutions for extraction and a number of other areas within the oil sands industry. And so during this episode, we're going to talk about product development, if you have an idea and how you actually seek out and protect that intellectual property. And we're also going to kind of get into the future of the oil and gas industry in Alberta, how we can really move the ball and embrace rapid innovation. And finally, kind of finish off, Jason comes through with the powerful message of change doesn't happen by itself. And so he kind of shares the message that you've got to be the change and take action. Thanks for joining us here and welcome to the show. It's my pleasure to have you join us here on the Oil Sand Tech Podcast. Jason is the founder of Crude Solutions, an entrepreneur and inventor by trade. And so Jason has had over 100 patents that have been filed in a various disciplines and as well as a number of focused on the SAGD side of extraction, which is really interesting to me. So Jason, yeah, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi, Aaron. Pleased to be here and thank you for the invitation. And yeah, I have been working in the oil and gas industry intellectually for the better part of 15 years now. And I'm always surprised at the attitudes you can still find out there at every major company working in the industry. Regarding innovation and out-of-the-box thinking. They very simply think, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and if it is broke, shut it down. Which is a shame, because there are a number of beneficial technologies that are sitting on their shelf simply because of the attitude, well, we always do it this way. The end of this story is, I guess I'm portraying it, is the industry it was more or less 50 years ago when you pick a target and you drill a hole, but now we can definitively say, there is this much oil or there's this much gas at this particular spot in the Earth's crust, and we can get there now with drilling technology. Mm-hmm. So, it's just a matter of, do you want to spend the money, and does your simulations bore out that you're going to get your money, and you know, what's your ROI, your return on investment? How long is it going to take to pump enough oil or gas out of that hole to get your money back, and what's the life of that hole, and et cetera, et cetera. So those are simple calculations once you know, from your seismic readings, how much oil or gas it may be in that general area. So that's kind of the business in a nutshell.
Yeah, it is a little challenging, I guess, considering the industry is risk adverse. But I think that there are big gains to be had implementing some of this technology, as we'll kind of get to a little bit later on in the interview here. But maybe we could shift now just to your own, I guess, personal journey building products and services here within the oil sands industry. So how did you get your start first developing technology?
Well, that started at a quite a young age. I began to question my entire environment, everything from my home life to my school life to my own life. And I saw a lot of disparity between what is real and what is perceived by each and every one of us. I mean, you see it in your everyday life, people doing the exact same thing over and over and over again and expecting a different result. You have to do something different. You can't just be same old, same old. You can't be the same guy every single day. The reality is that you have to look at your job that you're doing, and whether it's digging a ditch, whether it's coding for the next video game, if you can't think outside that box, then you're just going to keep sticking that shovel in the dirt, and you're going to keep throwing the dirt over your shoulder. And at the end of the day, you're going to get a ditch. And I guess if that's what you want and that's enough to keep you happy, you know, good on you, because I tell you, it's tough out there if you think you can change the world, because there's not a lot of people that can do that. And at the end of the story, it's a dynamic shift in philosophy that allows these people to have the belief and will to get out there and to affect the change that they believe in. And I admire all those people. I mean, they're trendsetters, and you know, it's a snowball. Once you get that, you know, that first snowball rolling down the hill, I think it's going to be a lot easier down the road to affect beneficial change. At the end of the story, that's, you know, I've always been thinking of, can't that be done better, or is there a better way? Or, you know, on the other side of the coin, I see a lot of things that are being done on the technology side, and I think, wow, that's amazing. Those are some very good ideas and very proactive people. And I mean, you look at Google and Apple and you think, wow, that's they're just fostering an out-of-the-box environment for thinking. And they bring the people in and they throw them all in a box. And, you know, it's almost like one of those, the analogy of if you put a million monkeys behind a million typers, sooner or later they're going to type out a Shakespearean sonnet. Well, that's kind of what, Google and Apple are doing. They're just grabbing all of the minds that they can and throwing them all in a box and seeing what comes out. And I mean, that's tremendous for the innovation side of things, because you need to be able to bounce ideas around, and you need to be able to do that unfettered by negativity. And you need people to sit there and ponder and say, oh, okay, well, you know, that's way out there. I mean, Google wants to launch balloons around the planet so that everybody has Wi-Fi. I mean, that's way out there. I mean, that is so far out there, literally and figuratively. But I mean, that's the kind of thinking that they can do there. And they can actually go out to the public and say, we want to launch balloons for worldwide Wi-Fi.
There are some really interesting ideas that are coming out. I mean, for example, another one that I was reading about is the, Google is developing a contact lens that will be able to tell somebody that has diabetes what their current blood sucrose level is.
When you look at Google, what were they, right? They're the largest search engine in the world. That's what they were. And now what are they doing? They're morphing into this huge entity that is going to, you know, it's already impacting our life, but it's going to impact our life tremendously, because they have no preset mandate. They have no corporate or preset corporate structure per se, in that we are only a tech, search engine. We're only for websites. We're only for, drilling down data that we collect off the internet. No, they're doing the smart car. They're doing, the driverless car. They're doing the global internet. They're doing, like you said, the diabetic contact lens. I mean, these guys are just reaching all over the place, and who knows where it's going to end up.
Yeah, it's really interesting as well. Like to an extent, from the looking from the outside, the corporate culture at Google, where I think it's 15% of the time people are able to work on their own individual projects. And I think some of the most successful products that they've had have actually came out of this kind of model. I know that I think Google Finance came out of that model, possibly Google News as well. But anyway, it's spellbinding from the outside, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's I'm sure they run through the, if you don't call them the kids or whatever, because they're embracing the young minds that are just getting out of university and whatever. But I'm sure they run through a lot of people, just because I can guarantee you that it's tough to have that mindset that you can think for yourself, as an example. So I'm sure they hire and fire, hundreds of people a year from there. But, it is an incubator. So, you know what, it's kind of like our world is going now, with the Ebola virus thing going on. It's sooner or later you get enough people together, something's going to happen, right?
Definitely.
That's just how it goes.
So can you share with us what really drives you?
Improving the world we live in, that's ideological goal of what I do. And, I mean, that's where I get the satisfaction, is if I can do something that has a beneficial effect on the world I live in. and hopefully the world that the other people live in. Unfortunately, that's a tough row to hoe. You'll see a lot of stuff, like I said, fall by the wayside or sit on the shelf, and you think, well, why is that not going on, or why is that not happening, or why is that not being used? That's the problem I see with the industry, is that it's a knee-jerk reaction, and they're not thinking ahead, and they're not thinking of, you know, what is 10, 20, 30 years down the road. They simply want to keep doing what they've been doing. It's working. It ain't broke. Don't fix it. And so that makes it tough, because when a company says, well, you know, we're making $100 million every quarter, what are we supposed to do? Why would we invest in new technology? Why would we look at new ways? I mean, we're making so much money that, I mean, imagine what you could do if you applied 10% of that to your R&D.
Yeah, there's a lot of the additive technologies. It's really interesting. So I don't know if you know this, but SpaceX, Elon Musk's space exploration company, I guess further their jet engines that they're building, each individual jet engine is unique because they're actually using a 3D printing process for making them. And I guess they're some sort of aluminum composite using like a laser 3D printer. Each individual engine, they're able to kind of change it and adjust it based on the design and what they think is they can kind of get a little bit more efficiency out of it. And these technologies is, I mean, just the thought of that for me is mind-blowing. The fact that you can go from a pile of metal into a rocket engine in you know, a couple weeks. And
that kind of segues into, I mean, when you were asking me about what technology really excites me, this is the type of technologies that I find really exciting, because, you know, it's all fine and dandy for to sit around and think of the, you know, the next or the better mousetrap or the best thing since sliced bread. But the reality is that, yes, you have the idea and you gestate it, and then you look at it and you think, well, you know, does it have an application anywhere in the world? And how can I get this out to the world? And does anybody really need it? Because one thing I find with inventors is that, you know, they become fixated on the fact that they think it's a great idea, when what they need to do is determine whether the world or their audience thinks it's a great idea. And that's one thing I find. I've consulted on a number of patents, is that when you talk to the people, they kind of get on a one-track mind, and it's like, no, this is how it should be, and this is how it'll go, and this is all going to work. And, you know, a product is really, especially when it's starting out, it's just like molding a child or whatever. It changes from day to day, from month to month. You know, you come up with different ideas, different solutions, and at the end of the story is back to your 3D printing analogy. That stuff is so amazing. I mean, I've gone to, as an example, I've been in the Ferrari factory, and when you see a block of aluminum that starts out at one end of the Ferrari factory, 6-8 hours later is a machined aluminum block for an F-45, and you look at that piece, I mean, it's just a marvel, as far as I'm concerned, of what technology does, because the human interaction was, you know, minimal. It was all machine driven. It's all very, 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 very precise, much more precise than humans could ever do. When you look at that happening and you watch it and you think, wow. And I mean, I was in there for 12 hours to watch the one piece of the one block of aluminum get to the end of the line, but you could see each step of the process, and there was 100 different processes along the way, from boring the cylinders to honing to machining the rod caps. I mean, it's a marvel of technology, and I think, wow, who figured all of that out? Like, who mapped that out? Who decided that this machine should be here, this tool should be used for this? I mean, that's, for me, that I marvel at that. I think, wow, that's, and you can see that in, I see that as just that's amazing technology, and as you noted, 3D technologies has the potential to bring that to every household in the world.
Maybe now we can just move a little bit over into what you've got going on with Crude Solutions and what you're currently working on.
With Crude Solutions, yeah, I've actually had a number of patents relating to enhanced oil recovery, or EOR, as they call it in the industry, and as the moniker says, enhanced oil recovery. So these patents relate to getting more oil out of the ground than is currently possible. Again, back to my comments earlier, it's not a rocket science. This is it's really quite simple. There are some interesting products and methods that, I mean, as I said, surprisingly, some of the stuff that I have patents on, I was shocked that I would get a patent on it, because I thought, this is just common sense. Why isn't somebody doing this in the first place? But I'm stubborn, so I said, wow, this is what I'm proposing. And as it turns out, I talked to a couple of people I know at the University of Alberta, because they're very involved in research and development, per se, in the oil and gas industry of Alberta. And they said, you know, Jason, we've never seen anything like that. You might have something there. So, I went the extra mile. I spent the money. I filed the patents. And lo and behold, two have been granted. Four others, I think, are pending on that particular technology. But I also have some other patents that were granted that are actual products that I hope to at some point integrate into the system, because the one is a replacement for slotted liner, and it's a very high performance part that, you know, is comparable, honestly, economically, to the cost of slotted liner, but it's a far superior product performance wise.
Can you walk us through, in terms of from idea to execution, how you built a prototype of any kind of any of the products that you have built, and also how you validated that idea? So you mentioned earlier how inventors sometimes can be fixated on how their idea is the best without working to actually figure out whether or not it is the best. And so if you could just walk us through how you validate your ideas and then move towards commercial application.
Honestly, I think the process for people of like minds, such as myself, it's going to vary for everybody, but there are some basic tenets that are applied to anything that you're doing. And I mean, I can use my EOR technology as a prime example. As I mentioned before, I had this idea having read reams of information and data on SAGD well production applications, as well as numerous patents relating to the same, and thinking, why isn't anybody doing what I think would be a really great idea? And so I like, as I mentioned before, I went to the University of Alberta, to people that I knew before in the industry, and talked to them, because they're on leading edge of research and development in Canada. And I said, you know, confidentially, I said, this is kind of what I'm thinking of. And they're like, well, can you explain it further? So it was a really simple drawing. And they said, that's very interesting. Can't say we've done it, but we'd love to run some simulations for you. So at the end of that story is, that gave me the backup information from experts in the industry to say that, you know, maybe I do have something, maybe there is something unique here. And so, I went ahead and filed multiple patents here in Canada, the U.S., Venezuela, et cetera. And anywhere there is heavy oil production, generally relating to thermal production. And at that point, then, after finalizing the patents, I went back to the university and we signed a contract to run simulations based on my inventions, and the simulations came back unbelievable. So I just have to stop there, because I'm not sure if that's exactly what you want to know, because I know you asked about validating, and if you're interested more, are you looking more for like what you do with a regular product, or are you talking,
I guess a regular product might be a little bit more applicable to the average guy.
It's the same kind of idea, right? I mean, I went to the University of Alberta to validate mine, and it's, that's, I guess, easier to do in the sense that when you go and you talk to an expert in thermal oil recovery and they say, you know, we've never seen it been done before, and we'd love to run some simulations for you, and you run the simulation and you get your results. You can't really do that with a mass consumer product, as an example. I mean, I've done those before as well. And what you need to do is, first of all, if you have that light bulb moment, is, you know, nowadays it's very easy. You just go on Google and search. And if you can't find anything on Google that's related or very similar to what you're thinking of, you know, then it's time to go to Google Patents and do your searches there. And, you know, put in the keywords that relate to your product. And I mean, that's time consuming and it's boring, and it's sometimes it's nerve wracking because you think, wow, you know, I have the light bulb idea, and you think, okay, well, let's just go and check it out, right? And I'll give you an example from my own perspective, is that I built some a golf club, a putter with movable weight technology back in the 90s for Gary Player. And I thought, you know, that for me was a light bulb moment. I thought, wow, you know, movable weight technology. You can't buy a golf club now, you know, a driver or even putters. They all have movable weight technology. And I thought of this in the early 90s. Gary Player had never seen anything like it. Lo and behold, it was done in the 30s. So.
Wow, all the way back in the 30s.
Yeah, unbelievable. Why in the world, you know, it's one of those things where you just say, how is that possible? But that's just how it is, right? Somebody thought of it in the 30s. I mean, they were using persimmon heads and brass sole plates. And, I mean, they had the inkling of what they wanted to do. But back then, the manufacturing technology wasn't what it is today. So they did the best that they could. And, you know, they use brass screws. They use, like I said, brass sole plates. They use brass screws in the face of the persimmon woods, and then they went to boring out basically the center of the persimmon wood and putting in a plastic insert so that the weight was more perimeter weighting. And famous guy, Carsten Solheim from Ping, he realized all of that before, I guess, anybody else did, and not only that, he had the smarts to develop, going back to our earlier topic, develop a way to manufacture, mass produce these perimeter weighted golf clubs. So at the end of that story is that you can have that light bulb moment. You can think that it's all great, and you can have people tell you that it's great. But if you don't do the legwork to find out if it's even patentable or protectable, or if there's any proprietary technology that you've thought of, it's a crapshoot. I mean, well, how else can you put it, right? If you want to skip a couple of steps along the way, you might get to the end of the story and think, wow, you know, look at my widget. My widget's selling a million pieces a day. And if you have no particular intellectual property to protect that, some of the big boys are just going to, like I said, they'll just run right over you and say, thanks a lot for validating the product and the market, and see you later, and you'll get nothing, and you'll sit there as I have before, and you just wonder why, you know, how does that happen? But that's business.
So what is the process like to file a patent?
Yeah, well, it's an involved process. Like I said, depending, you know, of where you're at, I guess, inventor-wise, if you got a lot of money, you can hire people to do the work, the legwork that I just mentioned with searching Google and Google patents and, you know, USPTO database and the CIPO databases, and you have to have some knowledge as well when you're doing your searches, because certain things can pop up, and if you can't narrow down your searches, you're going to get, you know, way too many responses that you can't read through them all, and you can't remember them all, and you'll never know if you have a patentable product or you don't. So depending where you're at, and depending also what type of product you have, I mean, if you're looking at a simple widget and you said, oh, okay, I'm going to just make a widget, and you go and look for widgets in the patent office and you can't find anything, whether it's design or utility, that process can be very short. I mean, you can get a design patent for a widget that nobody else has in 12 to 18 months in Canada, maybe 24 months in the U.S. But if you're looking at, say, something in the cellular phone industry or pharmaceutical industry, you can be looking at thousands and thousands of dollars of application fees. You can be looking at 4, 6, 8, 10 years of due process through the patent offices before you find out whether you actually are going to be issued a patent. And, you know, back to your question, is, what is the cost? If you were doing a simple widget, you could probably get a widget patent in the U.S. for $5,000 to $10,000. But if you were going to do a cellular phone or a pharmaceutical or a biological patent, you could be in $100,000, $200,000 easily.
So it's not for the light of heart.
No, not for light of heart, not at all. No, this is a process where, the majority of patents being filed for in North America are from individuals, people that believe they have the next best mousetrap. And if they aren't willing to sacrifice their time, effort, money, and, their family life to prove that to the world, it'll never see the light of day. So there's a lot of people that say, and like I said, because I'm... people that I know I'm an inventor. I've been doing it for 30 years, and they say, I get a call once a month from somebody saying, I've got the next best thing since sliced bread. And so then we talk about it for a little bit, and of course I'm way too easygoing with that in that regard, because I'm giving valuable information away. But I'm there to help people, and when somebody says this is the best thing since sliced bread, I just ask them a couple of questions, pointed questions, and it's like, I never thought of that. I didn't think of that.
It's an interesting point that we talked about earlier is the Howard Hughes, I guess, senior, like the aviator's father. He revolutionized the drilling industry back in the 30s. Could you tell us a little bit more about how that went? Because I think that represents a different kind of, maybe a different approach to the IP problem.
Yeah, well, that's a completely different era. I mean, there's no way you could do that in this day and age, simply because people are carrying their cell phones, people have access to the internet, people can snap a picture in 2 seconds, and they can then get a look at a product, they can get a look at a design, they can get a look at a procedure, they can get a look at a method instantly, and they can have that record forever. Back when Howard Hughes Sr. was developing the rotating drill bit, his whole idea was, and he was a smart man in that regard for his time, because he knew that if he filed a patent, as soon as that patent was public, everybody would know exactly what the Hughes oil tool was. And then he's looking at, competition, and instead of drilling holes, he'd be out policing the market. So his, and again, back then, this is the old boys club, so back then, all the Texans and Oklahomians and whatever that needed these wells drilled, Hughes Oil Tool would come out there and they'd say, no employees, no, only our employees, and everybody's under confidentiality agreements, and it was wrapped up tight, So they would go out there, they'd drill a hole for the customer, they'd charge them whatever they wanted because they were the best. Then they would take their tool back and go drill another hole. And this is how Hughes Oil Tool became, back in the day, the largest oil tool company in the world. And we're all familiar with what Howard Jr. did.
It's interesting, though, as well, going back to Howard Hughes. I know that Howard Hughes Jr., I guess, kind of blew through, a lot of the money and then kind of went a little crazy. But as an interesting piece of information, I guess at one point when he was in the depths of his challenges, he put all of his money into the Howard Hughes Foundation to study the center of life itself, is what they wanted to do. And they ended up mapping the human genome. Random piece of information to jump in there.
Yeah, a little segue, but is what happens, and this is what's missing from back to, if you want to segue back to what we started talking about, this is what the problem is with the oil and gas industry here. I mean, when I say everybody, the general public looks at our oil and gas industry here in Canada and says, boo, hiss, boo, right? Well, it's the number one economic driver in Canada,
yep.
Number one. But number two is that, using your example of Hughes Foundation mapping the human genome. This is what happens when you put a bunch of smart people together and they don't have to worry about paying their bills.
Mm-hmm.
They're just free thinkers. They can say, hey, what are we going to do? We've got to do, the world is our oyster. Let's see what we can do. And if the oil and gas industry in Canada would do the same thing, I think they would be shocked at what they would achieve. I mean, they would have the same result. I mean, we would figure out things. I mean, we got the computing power now. We got smart people. We got reams of data from historical context. So when you put that all together and you put some smart people in a room and you're not scared to bounce stupid ideas around, you know what? Sooner or later, you're going to hit the nail on the head, and it's going to be a eureka moment, and you're going to go, oh, wow, why weren't we doing that in the first place? You know, I can give you an example. 10 years ago, a good friend of mine, Hoda Lloyd Minister, and I went to make a pitch to a major thermal operator, and this is before the SAGD operations kind of thing, and they had a problem with their tailings ponds because the density of the water in the tailings fluid, which contained a lot of bitumen, was basically the same. So it was pretty hard to separate when you're using a density separator, which basically they were, you know, heating the tar sands, and this is open pit mining. So they basically dump a bucket of tar sands into a boiling pot, and they boil the oil and the sand and the water, and what you get is a froth that comes off the top, and the density of the oil, as long as it is different than the water, it's easy to separate. But the reality is that the density is very much the same for a lot of the bitumen. So they're throwing a lot of the oil, you know, it's like throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? So we went up there and we said, you got a big problem here, obviously, and that's why we're here. And we made this pitch and we said, you know, you need some type of different separation method. We made that pitch to them, and they said, no, we're not interested. You know, it's not where we're going and not where we're heading. It's just we're just going to let the oil settle out of the water. But so we said, you know, we just use a cyclone, and you can spin it, much like in, you know, your clothes in a washer, and you can get the oil to separate more consistently from the water. You can certainly get all of the minerals that are basically pollutants as well out of that oil using a cyclone. And, you know, they weren't interested 10 years ago, but now they're looking. I know one of the companies has adapted that technology right now. And
going back to the state of the industry in terms of innovation and bringing these big ideas from the outside in, so what do you think really needs to change in the industry in order to move to something where, I guess, where rapid innovation is kind of embraced?
You're never going to see that in the oil and gas industry. I mean, I shouldn't say not in my lifetime. I don't know how long I'm going to live, but no, they actually stifle, the industry is actually stifling innovation. I mean, they have, if you want to do anything with anybody, as an example in the oil and gas industry here, I mean, major inroads are required. I mean, I've looked at so many proposals for my technologies, and they say, oh, here's step one, and we got to get to step 56. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this is not, you don't need to overanalyze this. You don't need to do anything. All you need to do is stick this in a hole, and you'll find out in 24 hours whether it works or it doesn't work. And no one's willing to do that. They want to go through this whole process, and they want to analyze it. I mean, if, like I said before, there's companies. So, you know, it's like the chain gang thing, right? So as long as you have more than seven people chained together, the odds of them ever escaping are very slim, because you can never convince all seven people to run at the same time, and that's why chain gangs became what they were. And the same thing is happening in this industry, is that you get 15, 20, 30 talking heads in a room trying to decide whether technology is beneficial or not beneficial. You're going to get nowhere, because at the end of the day, some people are going to say yay and the other people are going to say nay. And, you know, there's a lot of ego involved. When some guy says, you know, I'm head of research and development for company A, and the other guy says, well, I'm head of research and development for company B, and these people just butt heads. back to your question, how is innovation going to happen? It's going to take, and this is probably a good thing, it's going to take public pressure. You know, the image, they want to clean up the image. Technology can do that for them, but, you know, they're looking at it as well as what's the cost? What's the cost to me? Like carbon, CSS, carbon sequestration technology, where they want to pump the carbon back into the ground instead of out of the coal stacks. Huge cost, massive cost to the producer of the electricity. I mean, they have to do it, otherwise the government's going to run them out of business. So that's, you know, and it's not just the government, I guess it's the people. But
there is a lot of challenges associated with the, I guess, bringing in these innovative technologies within the industry. But if there was a company that was going to take kind of an approach like, let's say, like Google or one of these bigger technology companies where they are willing to explore, I guess, other alternatives, like, what would that look like in your opinion?
With respect to the oil and gas industry?
Yeah, with respect to the oil and gas industry. With respect to,
I would love to see somebody like a Google take a run at the oil and gas industry, and I would embrace that because, like I said, if you put 10 petroleum engineers that graduated from either, you know, University of Calgary, University of Alberta, whatever, in the same room, and you said, solve this problem, you'd have no hope of solving that problem because they all went to the same school. They all were taught the same thing. They all lived in the same box, and they all live in the same box now. So if you took the Google approach and you said, you know, let's bring in a bunch of people that have nothing, no prior knowledge, they have no idea, and we bring them from different industries, and we bring them together, and we throw them in a room, and we say, you guys are just locked in that room until we figure out a way to solve this problem, I guarantee you solve that problem pretty quick. And that's all that would be required, really, is, you know, you just need to be in a that type of situation where you can bounce ideas off each other, and just as we discussed with Google, and you can say, you know, let's do this, let's do that, let's try this, let's think about that, let's, you know, show me this equation, show me this drawing, let's map this out, this is what we can do. You will come up with a solution to your problem. We just need to get some people from outside the industries, whatever industry you want to change, because they're the ones that can look from the outside in. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're in the industry, you're always looking from the inside out. If they could ever do something like that, bring a focus group together and say, you know, here you go, guys, we'll pay you for your 30 days. We want to bring some of the better minds together from other industries, and we want you to just sit down and give us what you think, give us your best guess at what we can do to solve some of our problems that we have in our industry. You'll come up with a solution, guaranteed.
Yeah, it's interesting on that point, too, in terms of bringing in diverse kind of people to solve problems. So living over here in China, something that I've done over the past year is I ended up running a human-centered design course along with a number of other people here that are involved in the startup community. And human-centered design is the methodology of design that's coming out of the Stanford Design School. And the idea is you bring people together from various different industries, and it could be everyone from architects, lawyers, you know, laborers, petroleum engineers, and you have a specific problem that you're looking at solving. And so when you're able to bring these people together from many diverse backgrounds, you have completely different solutions that you'd never even think about kind of come out of it. And so I think that is really powerful, trying to use that kind of external approach.
Yeah, and you know what? Google is a prime example. So, I mean, that's just, it's hard to imagine that other industries can't figure that out. I mean, here's a room full of coffee and donuts, and, you know, we'll open the door once you figure this out. They'll figure it out pretty quick, and it'll be nothing the research and development engineer would have ever thought of. Let's take a concentrated effort or look at this problem, and let's see if we can find a solution, because you're going to find solutions. You're going to have different ideas. You're going to have completely different perspective of what you're looking at, because somebody that's, you know, in the kitchen frying an egg every single day in a diner, all he is ever going to see every morning when he cracks that egg in the pan is an egg. But you bring in an artist, bring in a musician, you bring in a graphic designer, who knows what he's going to see, right?
Yeah, just as using that as a segue here, it's been great having you on the show today, and so maybe we can finish things off here, and if you could provide us with a last piece of advice for the inventor or the innovator out there that's listening to this podcast.
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, it's kind of been the focus of what we've been talking about from the get go is that change, you know, doesn't happen on its own. So if you're the kind of person, and it's tough, people don't embrace change. People fight change, and you know, I can't say I'm totally different than the regular people, because as an inventor, I know how hard the concept is to grasp for 99% of the population. Because, like I said, in some ways, I don't embrace change. I mean, my wife tells me, you know, do something this way that I've always done the other way, and I think, why would I ever want to do that? You know, why fold the clothes this way, or why wash the floor this way? And the problem is that, you know, what we know and what is there and what we've been doing, that's comfortable and easy for us. And change, obviously, is different. So it's tough. It's a challenge. It takes courage, brains, and stubbornness to actually affect beneficial change. So, I mean, if that sounds like your kind of person, you know, by all means, as Nike likes to say, just do it. Because at the end of the day, I can guarantee you no one is going to do it for you. You can talk till you're blue in the face. You can analyze till you're red in the face. You can put all the pros and cons down and do all you want. But at the end of the day is, you know, you either step up to the plate or you don't. And sometimes it is hard. It's tough to swing away and fail. And trust me, I've done it. And it's tough, but it needs to be done. And, you know, you have to look at failure as well as an opportunity, because you learn something. I mean, you found out what was wrong. You found out some information. You got some data. You got some information. You got something to build off of. And next time around, you know, who knows? And I'm not saying that you're going to fail, you know, right out of the gate. But I'm just saying is that you have to realize that failure is just part of life. And so you're going to fail a lot more than you will succeed. But, you know, embrace both. Embrace failing because you're going to learn something, and embrace succeeding because, you know, if you don't step up to the plate and swing, then you're just sitting in the stands.
Yeah, that is such a powerful message, failing forward and constantly learning and growing. And it's because I think as a society, we're so afraid of failure. It's kind of, it's looked down upon. And but if you don't fail, I mean, are you really pushing hard enough, or are you really moving to that next level, you know?
I mean, that's just how it is. We learn that as kids growing up, unfortunately. It's a two-sided sword there, because you can say, as an example to your teacher, that, you know, 4 + 4 = 9, and she can explain to you how it's 8, and there's a lesson to be learned there, and you learn that lesson. But we forget all about that as we get older, and all of a sudden, we don't want to fail.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we kind of finish off here, is there a way that, I guess, listeners can get in touch with you, or what's the best way to kind of reach out?
And check out my website. So you can go on LinkedIn. You can find me on LinkedIn. You can, you know, it's not hard if you want to look. If you can't find me, you're not looking too hard. How's that?
Okay, great. And in the show notes here, I'll include your website and LinkedIn profile as well.
Sure, that'd be great, Aaron. I appreciate you having me on, and it's enjoyable chatting.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Oil Sand Tech Podcast. Yeah, sharing your knowledge and your journey. And keep on struggling and keep on working and building and creating and keep on going, you know?
Yeah, for me, it's like breathing. I just have to do it. Like, it's not like, I don't know. It's strange that way. My wife thinks I'm nuts, but, like I said, for me, if I have to take a breath, I have to think of, you know, I have to try to think of something or whatever. It's crazy. It's a crazy life, but you know what? I wouldn't have it any other way. And like I said, I failed, and I'm going to fail again. I don't doubt that. But you know what? I'm learning as I grow, and got to be happy with that result. Or at the end of the day, because you're not going to hit a home run every time you get up to the plate.
Thank you so much for listening all the way through to the end of episode 2. Head to our website at oilsandtech.com, where you can sign up for our mailing list and also for our meetup. The Oil Sand Tech meetup has just gone live within the last week, and we've actually had over 50 people that have signed up for it. So the Oil Sand Tech meetup is a kind of a social platform, a networking group of people that are interested in building products and services to solve oil sands problems. So over the next year, we'll be holding various events in Edmonton, Calgary, and Fort McMurray, focusing on product development, product design, applying startup methodologies to the oil sands and in the oil sands. How do you actually take an idea and turn it into a solution that provides value and ultimately turns into a business? On December 10th, we'll be holding the kickoff for the Oil Sand Tech Meetup in Calgary. And in January, we'll be in Edmonton, and February, we'll be up in Fort McMurray. Head to oilsandtech.com, and thank you so much.